This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. Our big topic today, the stock market. What happened in the stock market last week? Is there more to come? I'll give you my take and why. Also joining me on today's program, Mr. Carl Denninger. We'll be chatting with Carl about his view on what's going on in the economy and the markets. We'll get his forecast for the market, and you won't want to miss that. I'll be talking to Carl in a couple segments on today's program. Let me remind you that we do have some free educational resources available to you. I'll be having Mr. Denninger join me here in just 1 minute. If you've not yet attended our new retirement rules class, in light of what's going on in the markets, I would encourage you to do so just so you get another perspective. You can get more information by visiting the website newretirementrules.com. The website, again, newretirementrules.com. You can register for the class there while capacity remains, or you can get more information. Also, if you'd like to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter delivered via email, that newsletter is titled Portfolio Watch. You can get a free subscription so you can get our weekly analysis of what's going on in the markets by visiting the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. The website is yourretirementoutlook.com. That's Y-O-U-R, retirementoutlook.com. Enter your name and email, and we'll be glad to put you on the list. And keep in mind, we never share your information with anyone. Again, the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. I'm pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio program Mr. Carl Denninger. Carl is a very prolific writer. You can read his work at market-ticker.org. I check it out frequently and encourage you to do the same thing. Carl, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Carl, let me just get your take. We've been talking a lot here on the program about China's actions to devalue their currency. Is this the beginning of currency wars that maybe are going to intensify globally? What's your take?
I think there's a little more to it than that, and it's on the one hand a little more nuanced, and on the other hand, continuation of policies that started in the United States and Europe after 2008. If you remember, we undertook rounds of quantitative easing, and that is nothing other than currency devaluation, because what you're doing is emitting credit into the marketplace with nothing behind it. You're having the government do it, but that's really not different than the Chinese government telling the People's Bank of China to do it when they're both the same thing, right? So China is getting caught by their own hubris and claims of economic growth that are rooted in doing things like building cities that nobody lives in. You can only do that for a certain amount of time. Now you have to actually find some way to make those assets that you built productive, otherwise the carrying costs collapse back on themselves. And so their banking sector is in real trouble. Do I think this is going to continue? Yeah, right up until the margin calls catch up with everybody and this whole house of cards comes down on their heads.
So, Carl, when you look at the Chinese economy and look at the level of debt that exists at local government levels, that's been piling up since 2008, and you look at their real estate market and look at what's happened in the stock market with huge corrections in the Chinese stock markets, are we seeing the beginning of a deflationary period in China?
I think there's some chance that that happens. Of course, the thing about being a communist country is that you can do what Ben Bernanke claimed he could do but never managed to pull off, which is, his old claim that that any central bank that's sufficiently determined can halt the deflation. The problem, of course, is that, this assumes that said central bank either exists in a vacuum or can turn around and order the government to pull out guns and start shooting people, or that they are the government. And in a communist country, that kind of thing can happen. In market economies, it's much more difficult because capital is free to move. And where you have convertibility and free exchange of capital, you really can't get away with that sort of thing. So, I think this is the start of an unwind of much that's gone on in China. The so-called miracle is being exposed as false, just like the Japanese miracle was exposed as being false. And, Abe and his merry band have been trying to produce, quote-unquote, inflation for a long time, But what he wants is asset price inflation. He doesn't want grocery price inflation because wages aren't going up. So, you know, you don't want people to go hungry because that tends to get rather destabilizing for your, you know, the civic side of your government.
Kyle, when you start talking about currency devaluation, it also brings up a very important point. When you look at economic growth or measures of economic growth, typically that's measured in terms of a currency, as are stocks. So is the metric changing to make the asset prices look better? And what's your take on that? Can you comment?
Oh, absolutely. And this is why GDP statistics are utterly misleading at best and fraudulent at worst. You really don't care how many dollars worth of cars you made, okay, when you get to the end of the day. What you care about is how many vehicles, how many usable vehicles, and what the output was and what it means to your economy. The denominator, if you change the denominator, then of course that number is falsely represented. And one of the first things you learn in algebra class when you're in junior high or high school is that if you've got a term like that that's on both sides of an equation, you have to remove it in order to produce anything that means something. So this has been the way of the world, if you will, over the last 30 or so years. We've seen a globally declining rate environment that allows people to turn around and borrow and spend additional funds, which is inflationary, while paying the same amount of interest coupon over time. So as rates go from, say, 10% to 1%, you could have 10 times as many units of currency outstanding and pay the same amount of interest. The problem, of course, comes that when you've established this as the trend and how you've generated your so-called growth numbers, and then you reach the zero boundary, you can't do that anymore. And if rates go up, then you have to somehow get rid of that debt, and of course you don't have the money because you already spent it. But the thing that gets a lot of people is they say, well, you know, the Fed or the People's Bank of China or whoever could just leave rates very low or even at zero. And the answer to that is it doesn't matter if they do, because these so-called growth numbers were predicated upon being able to take out ever larger amounts of debt. And that capability ends when rates reach a zero boundary.
Carl, let's talk about if this currency devaluation continues worldwide and we have this race to the bottom, as I like to think about it, does that mean that trade wars are inevitably going to follow?
Probably in some regard. The bigger issue, I think, in terms of whether or not we get an all-on sort of trade war is at what point do the people of this country refuse to take upon themselves the damage that the Chinese economy has inflicted on itself, and yet they're now trying to shove off on other people, including us. And that's a political question for our government and for the people in this country to answer, because that needs to stop. This is a large part of where our unemployment problem has come from in the devaluation of our job base. We've generated a great number of jobs since the formal end of the recession, but they're almost all in low-paying services, and manufacturing continues to be offshored, as do higher-paying engineering jobs, for example, software development, things like this. That process needs to stop and be reversed in order for our economy to return to vibrancy. And yet what China's doing is essentially trying to continue to export that factor with our labor going towards them. I don't think it's going to work. I think they've reached the point where they can't manage to make enough in return, nor can they accumulate the reserves to make that work anymore. And so now we've got the desperate flailing in the pool as you start to suck on the water instead of the air.
Well, our guest today is Mr. Carl Denninger. Carl's work can be read at at his blog, actually, at market-ticker.org. I would encourage you to check it out. I do so often myself. And we will continue our conversation with Carl when Everything Financial Radio continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I will continue my conversation with our special guest this week, Mr. Carl Denninger, in the next segment. You know, given what's happened in the stock market this past week, that obviously rather needs to be a topic of conversation today. The stock market, when measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average this past week, dropped 1,000 points in one day before recovering a bit. We've seen a lot of massively up days and a lot of massively down days. When we see that type of behavior in the market, we call that volatility. We say the market is volatile. Now, if you've been a longtime listener to the Everything Financial Radio program, you know that we have been predicting increasing stock market volatility, and we have been forecasting over the longer term not just a correction in stocks, but really a major decline. I believe that what we're seeing in the market now is the volatility that typically precedes a major decline. Now, the what, admittedly, is a lot easier to predict than the when. And what I mean by that is what will happen, given the facts and circumstances, is much easier to predict than when it might happen, although no forecast is foolproof. Now, back in June of 2014, about a year ago, a little over that actually, I did a show and talked about the fact that there are some signs that the stock market is topping. Now, that was a year ago, but we live in extraordinary times, and I'll talk about that a bit in this segment, but I want to go back in this segment and revisit what we talked about a year ago, because what we talked about a year ago is actually now coming to pass. The first thing that I talked about on that program is that stocks at that time were trading at historically high price-to-earnings multiples or price-to-earnings ratios. Now, price-to-earnings ratios are simple to calculate. You simply take the price of a company's stock per share and divide that by the earnings of that particular company per share, and you come up with a price-to-earnings ratio. So, for example, if the stock is selling for $10 a share and the earnings of that particular company are $1 a share, it's 10 divided by 1, and you would have a price-earnings ratio of 10. Now, if you go back and look at these price-earnings multiples, historically speaking, during the peak of the tech bubble, we've seen P.E. ratios get to almost 40. And if you go back to the beginning of what we call the economic spring season in 1948, stocks traded at a multiple or a price-earnings ratio of 6. So that's a very, very big range. Now, I pointed out back in June of 2014 that stocks were currently trading at about 22 times trailing earnings. So that meant that for every $22 that a $22 in share price, there was $1 worth of earnings. And I also pointed out that corporate profits were forecasted to slow. So when you look at forward price earnings ratios, which really are projections based on future projected earnings, and Wall Street typically likes to use forward price earnings ratios. They like to look into their crystal ball and figure out what earnings might be and calculate a price-earnings ratio based on that number. I prefer to use trailing. Now, given that the price-earnings ratio at the time was 22 and they'd been as high as 40 during the tech stock bubble, was it possible that stocks could go higher? Absolutely. And, in fact, they did, because at the time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was just below 17,000. It got up north of 18,000, and now obviously with this past week's correction, it's below that. But historically speaking, when you look at price-to-earnings ratios, when price-to-earnings ratios go over 20, it typically makes sense to sell stocks, and when they're below 10, it makes sense to buy them. Now, the second indicator that I talked about on that particular program, which is somewhat related to price-earnings ratio, at least it's a lot like price-to-earnings ratio, is a dividend yield. Now, dividend yields have fluctuated wildly, and if you look at the S&P 500, for example, the aggregate dividend yield of the S&P 500 exceeded 10% during the Great Depression. That meant if you invested in stocks, you got a good dividend yield. That was after stocks corrected significantly. And of course, it's no surprise to many of you listening that when stocks correct, they tend to overcorrect. And when stocks rally, they tend to over-rally, at least based on dividend yields and price-to-earnings ratios. Now, when you look at the tech bubble, the aggregate dividend yield of the S&P 500 was lower than the 1.8% that it is today. But 1.8% today is a very low dividend yield. Now, again, when you look at historically, what are the numbers? Historically, stocks have been a strong buy when dividend yields are over 6%, and they've been a sell when they dip below 3%, and we're well below that currently. So when you look at the fact that price-earnings ratios are higher than the historical average, and dividend yields are lower than the historical average, you've got a couple things that have to make you think, wait a minute, if I'm in stocks, maybe it makes sense for me to think about or consider protecting my positions. Now, there are those that will say dividend yield today is really not a very good indicator to look at because companies are buying back stock in lieu of paying dividends, but I would say that a company will raise its dividend only when it's confident it can sustain the dividend. So I think that that is still a very relevant factor. Now, the third thing I pointed out is that the Federal Reserve at the time was talking about tapering. Back in June of 2014, the Federal Reserve was still literally printing money, and they were using that money to buy mortgage-backed securities and treasuries. Well, whenever money is created, whenever money is printed, it will find a home. And Federal Reserve policy stimulated, in my view, the stock market and made it move higher as a result. But Fed policy had another, maybe unintended, side effect. If you are a retired or maybe close to being retired investor, if you want to try to go get a yield on a fixed interest investment, something that's relatively safe, that's very difficult to do. CD yields are low. Interest rates are low, and the Fed policy has hurt savers. So, consequently, what have savers decided to do? Many savers have said, hey, I can't get a return in a fixed interest safe investment, so let me go out and buy stocks that will pay me a dividend. So, Fed policy has not only stimulated the market, it's also forced many investors who are managing a nest egg who would otherwise be fairly conservative into more risky investments so they can get yield. Now, what's happened? Well, the Fed has tapered. They've stopped their quantitative easing program as of October of last year. And since that time, we have seen the market actually begin to slow down or taper as well. Now, I'll talk about, and when Everything Financial Radio continues, a couple of other factors, but let me share with you what our long-term forecast is. We believe, as I outline in my book, New Retirement Rules, that debt excesses in the private sector today are similar or even greater than they were at the beginning of the Great Depression. If you look at private sector debt levels today, when measured as a percentage of the economy, they're 50% larger than at the beginning of the Great Depression. During the Depression, debt was purged from the system, and we believe debt will have to be purged from the system again. We believe that will be deflationary, and unless the Fed decides to engage in quantitative easing or money printing again, full tilt, we believe that stocks will have to correct significantly. We have forecast that by the end of this economic winter season that stocks and gold will be on par. So if you measure stocks by using the Dow Jones Industrial Average, we believe the Dow will reach a 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 level, and we believe gold will reach that level as well. And I know that sounds hard to believe. However, we talk about it in our new retirement rules class, and we give you historical data that we believe is very difficult to argue with. If you'd like to learn more, particularly in light of what's going on in the stock markets, I would invite you to visit the website, newretirementrules.com. You can get more information about our class coming up on September the 12th. That will be held at the East Beltline campus of Western Michigan University. You can register online as well while capacity remains. Again, the website, newretirementrules.com. I'll be back after these words.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Monday, Monday, Monday. Always Sunday. In the rich man's world.
This is Everything Financial Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and I have the pleasure of chatting once again today with a fairly frequent guest here on the program, Mr. Carl Denninger. If you're just joining us, Carl's blog can be read at market-ticker.org, and I would encourage you to check that out. We've been talking with Carl about currency devaluation that's taking place all around the world. And, Carl, you know, when you look at, we talked about in earlier here on the program, we talked about China devaluing their currency. We talked about the United States engaging in quantitative easing. Britain has done the same thing. We're seeing the European Central Bank now engaging in the same thing. So worldwide, we've got this race to the bottom. What's the end game, and when does it stop, and what does it look like when it does stop?
I think we're starting to see the end game now, and we're starting to see the what's it look like when it stops. Despite the fact that the Fed has continued to jawbone about maintaining easy policy, and all the talking heads on TV are saying so as well, the problem you've seen over the last few months is that the stock market acceleration has tapered off. The internal breadth has gotten very bad. You've got a smaller and smaller number of issues that are holding up the averages. And if you look at the S&P 500, for example, 20% of it at this point is in a literal bear market, that is more than 20% off its highs. So in terms of the actual structure of the market, it's deteriorating quite rapidly and badly. But you have a handful of companies that are maintaining price and accelerating price, and that continues to make everything look okay. This is the same sort of thing that happened in 2000. The NASDAQ cracked, and a bunch of high-flying companies all crashed. And there was a large body of thought at the time that nothing terrible was going to happen to either the broader economy or the broader market for that matter. And in fact, the S&P 500 did not roll over and falter for almost another year. So, but ultimately it lost half its value. Okay, so the so-called tech companies that didn't make any difference to anybody ultimately came back around and dragged the entire market into the toilet. And the same sort of thing is likely to happen this time. You're hearing the same sort of protests from people in the media that what's going on in China isn't going to come back around here and infect us. That's fantasy land nonsense, because the only reason that the Federal Reserve and the federal government have gotten away with the sort of debt issuance that they've done over the last 7 or 8 years is because China's been absorbing that, and that's been going out of our country in the form of trade imbalance. That's how this works at a mathematical level. Well, that now is going to stop. It has to stop. And when it does, then the ability of the federal government and the Federal Reserve to play this sort of game and not have the impact land on us goes away. So it won't happen immediately, but I think you're starting to see the beginning of it as things stand right now. And over the next certainly by the end of the year, and into next year, I think you're going to see the real impact, and it could come much sooner than that. There's always the chance of an Asian contagion kind of dislocation move that comes out of some international organization that is has much greater exposure to this than anyone's letting on. I mean, that's the sort of thing that we saw happen with Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and stuff like that. And that kind of thing is very possible. In fact, I'd rank it as rather likely simply because of the size of the Chinese economy.
Carl, one of the things that that occurs to me as you were talking is that when you look at the Fed's interest rate policy after we saw the tech stock crash rather back in 2000 to 2001, interest rates were reduced, and the same thing happened. Bernanke dropped rates after the financial crisis. They've been at zero ever since. Does the Fed have any bullets left in the gun if we see this stock market correction that you seem to be forecasting? And correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, and that's exactly the problem, is that the Fed has not gotten the result they wanted over the last 8 years. So they've kept their policies in the belief that if you continue to do the same thing long enough, eventually they'll work. They ran a grand experiment on all of us with absolutely no reason to believe empirically that it would function the way that they envisioned. It didn't. They kept it up. And now they've kept it up well beyond the normal tipping point in the business cycle, which, and that is a normal thing. Expansions and contractions and overexuberance and then, you know, things reverting back to the mean is a totally normal sort of policy thing. It happens all the time, and there isn't anything you can do to prevent it. So now we're going into the backside of this cycle with the Federal Reserve having essentially nothing it can do about it. So I, you know, if we take the current, the last quarter's earnings numbers, and you send those out 4 quarters, and as you say, this wasn't an anomaly. This is kind of where we're going to be for a while. Oil stays low, energy is in terrible shape, and the rest of the market kind of goes the way it has been. It suggests that the market is currently overvalued by about 35%. So if you then add to that some contagion from the Chinese situation and no more accommodation available from the Fed, you could easily see the indices get cut in half.
So, Carl, would that be your forecast that we could see the S&P 500 and the Dow actually, you know, experience a 2001 or 2008 style correction?
I think you could. I don't think it will come all at once. I don't see the elements to create the kind of cascade selling and crash behavior that we saw back in 2008. But of course, unless you have the inside scoop on where the cross exposure is between firms, you never see those before they happen. But a grind lower does the same damage to you over the intermediate term. It doesn't really make any difference whether it comes in, 3 days or 6 months, right?
Carl, assuming stocks decline, and our forecast has been something similar, that we'll see a significant decline, maybe as much as 60%, what do you think that does as far as U.S. government bonds are concerned? I mean, investors are going to look for safety somewhere. With already very low yields, do you think yields go lower and bonds go higher?
Well, that's this is the paradox. The expectation from virtually everybody has been to shoot the longer end of the curve because they believe that rates are going to go up, and that means prices are going to go down. of course, everybody thought that was going to happen in Japan too, if you remember, after their market crashed, and the government started doing the sort of quantitative easing and low interest rate policies that we've been running with. And in fact, everybody who tried to do that got carried out on their shields. So this sort of environment, everybody around through our government and through our Fed have said, oh, we're not Japan. If you remember, Bernanke made a lot of noise about that over the last few years of his tenure, that, oh, no, we won't have that kind of thing happen to us here. Well, it's happening now. So I think you have to expect as the base case that if the stock market does collapse to any material degree, certainly if we see a 30, 40, 50, 60% drawdown in equity prices, yeah, people are going to go into treasuries. Where else would you go? I also think that there's real risk, very severe risk in the high yield market because so much of what's been done to engineer these numbers and engineer the market higher has been debt stock buybacks. What happens when those corporate balance sheets become impaired and then that debt has to be rolled over?
So Carl, I'm assuming then that you're bearish on stocks moving ahead. You would be bullish on U.S. treasuries. Are there any other asset classes that look attractive?
Not really. Somewhere down the road, I get very interested in energy simply because behind every unit of economic output is a unit of energy. But I think it's too early. There have been a lot of people trying to catch that falling knife, and it's been a chainsaw. So, trying to call a bottom in oil, for example, at this point, I think is a fool's game. I want to see some evidence that demand is stabilizing. Right now it's not there, and that supply isn't, we're not going to get a large amount of supply coming on from, say, for example, Iran, which, of course, everyone thinks is going to happen at this point. So there's a real problem here with that. But, here in the United States, the bigger problem from the standpoint of lower commodity prices is that it's not filtering through to people. You look in the Midwest right now, they've got a refinery offline, and gas prices went up almost a dollar in the space of a couple of days. So the benefit from this is not ending up in the consumer's pocketbook.
Carl, when you look at gold, with all this money printing, money creation that's taking place around the world, how do you explain that gold has actually declined significantly over the last 3 years, and the last really 8-9 months or so has been kind of in a trading range?
I am not particularly bullish of things that are doomsday assets and that are sold that way, especially when they're looked at as inflationary hedges, and gold's in that category. And I simply point out that those people who have been, that were predicting extremely high gold prices over the last, 5-6 years, we all heard, gold is going to $5,000 an ounce, and, you'd better buy it now because that's where it's going. And we've heard that ever since it broke out above the, the $800-$900 area. It got up to 1900 and now you've lost, about 40% of your money if you bought it up there. So I'm looking at this from a little different perspective. I mean, I look at gold, it's basically round tripped from back where it was in 2010. That doesn't look like a good investment to me.
Carl, does that mean if you're not bullish on gold, does that mean that moving ahead that you would be, just by default, bullish on the U.S. dollar?
Yeah, at this point, I think that, I don't see the inflationary impulse that people believe is going to envelop us and kill us. And my view as a businessman first and a trader, second, third, fourth, and fifth, is that I always want to buy things when they're cheap because that's how you really make your money. Okay, you don't make money buying something when it's expensive and selling it to someone else at an even higher price. That's a loser's game because if you're wrong, you're going to get your head chopped off. That's how you lose half your money. So I want to buy things when they're very inexpensive, when people have to sell. That's when I want to be purchasing them, and I want to be purchasing productive assets. And I don't have anything right now in that area that looks good. Land is too expensive because of the low interest rates and being very cheap. But there's a lot of people who have gotten in over their heads with machinery, with land, real estate, and everything related to it. As that cycle turns, I think you're going to get a good opportunity, but it's not here today.
So, Carl, last question, I guess, two-part question then.
Sure.
One, I would take it that then you're really pretty excited about holding a fair amount of cash in your portfolio, and two, based on the comment that you just made, you would be somewhat bearish on real estate investments as well.
I would be very bearish right now about real estate. I'd be very worried about buying a top, especially in residential. Commercial is still grossly oversupplied, in my opinion. You look at the number of retail square foot per capita in the United States versus other countries. We're overbuilt almost 2-to-1. There's no reason for me to get involved in that market at all. And cash, when I don't have anything else to buy, I have to take the risk of depreciation of my currency, but at least I know how many dollars I have.
We're going to have to leave it there. Carl, thank you for being on the program today. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
No problem at all. Thank you very much for having me on.
And just a quick reminder, you can read Carl's work at market-ticker.org. I would encourage you to check it out. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and thanks to our special guest, Mr. Carl Denninger, for joining us on today's program. Our topic today is stocks, given that the Dow Jones Industrial Average last week experienced a 1,000-point drop during the course of a day, the worst point drop in history. That's a point drop, not on a percentage basis. The flash crash of 87 was actually far worse on a percentage basis. Is there more stock market volatility? Is there a stock market decline coming? And the answer to that, in my view, is yes. And I think you'd be well served to take a look at your investment portfolio and certainly put some safeguards in place. And we've been talking about this on the program for quite a long time. In fact, earlier on Everything Financial Radio, I talked about the fact that back in June of 2014, I talked about the five signs that the stock market was likely topping out. Now, granted, that's been a little over a year ago, and certainly when you look at The stock market, when you look at the economies fundamentally, the what is going to happen is far easier to predict than the when something is likely to happen. And the simple reason for that is that it's very difficult to predict what the policy response will be of, say, the Federal Reserve. If you take a look at what happened in the stock market correction of 2007 to 2008 during the financial crisis, we had the banking system collapsing. We had a bailout. We had the Federal Reserve implement policies that avoided this debt collapse, if you will, for the up until now. But now we believe that this is going to be unavoidable. We have on next week's program joining us, Mr. Ian Gordon. Ian will give us an update on where he sees things going, and certainly you won't want to miss that as well. Now, the five signs the market is topping out. Earlier on Everything Financial Radio, I talked about the fact that stocks are trading with historically high price-to-earnings multiples. I explained that a price-earnings multiple is simply the price of a stock divided by the earnings per share of that particular stock. And today, stocks are trading well over 20 times earnings. And historically speaking, it's been a good time to sell stocks when their price-to-earnings multiple exceeded 20 and buy them when their price-to-earnings multiple is less than 10. Secondly, I talked about the fact that dividends today are historically low. During the Great Depression, the dividend yield of the S&P 500 in the aggregate exceeded 10%. Today, about 1.8%. And historically speaking, stocks have been a buy when dividend yields have exceeded 6% and a sell when they dip below 3%. The Federal Reserve has tapered since October of last year. They've disengaged from the quantitative easing or money printing program that was in place. Whenever money is created, it finds a home, and Fed policy has forced a lot of otherwise conservative investors into the market so they can get some yield. As you all know, there's not any yield to speak of in fixed interest type investments. Now, the last two items that I'll spend this segment talking about are that investors up to this point have been irrationally bullish on the stock market. You know, when you take a look at the crowd is almost always wrong. There is a measure of bullishness or bearishness on the stock market called the Investor Sentiment Index. And when the overwhelming majority of investors are bullish, almost always historically, we are at or near a top. And when the overwhelming majority of investors are bearish, we're near a bottom. A good example of this is that in March of 2009, over 90% of investors were bearish, and that turned out to be the market bottom. So certainly, when you look at the level of bullishness today, it is near a record high as well. At least it was prior to the beginning of what we believe will be a long-term correction as of last week. Now, here is the real factor. Here's something that not many folks are talking about, but we think it's really important, and that is simply that margin debt is at an all-time high. Simply put, when investors are positive, they want to own more stock than they can afford. That means they borrow money to buy stock, which means they're buying stock on margin. Well, in June of 2014, margin debt sat at about $450 billion. When I pointed that out on the radio program over a year ago, I was skeptical that it could go much higher, but it has. It is presently at about $500 billion. Now, this is higher than it was at the 2007 peak, which means today investors have borrowed more money to buy stock than they did just prior to the 2007 to 2008 correction. Now, the interesting thing is, or the difficult thing is, that margin debt requires that a certain amount of equity is held in your account. So just for example, let's say that you have an account with a brokerage company with $1 million in it. You would have to keep $500,000 worth of equity in that account. Now, as long as the price of stocks continues to go up, the equity in the account grows, and you can actually buy more stock as stock prices go up. Well, if you can buy more stock as stock prices go up, the opposite is also true. You have to sell more stock as stock prices decline. For example, if your million-dollar account has $500,000 worth of equity in, but now the stock market corrects and you have $900,000 of total value in the account, you have to have $450,000 in equity, so you have to eliminate some stocks. You have to sell stocks in order to bring the equity back into line. So as stocks decline, the more margin debt there is, the more this margin debt exacerbates or accelerates a stock market decline. Now, if you are to map out the level of margin debt that has existed on the New York Stock Exchange, and the most recent month for which we have statistics is the month of July, and in the month of July, margin debt was up 1.2% from the month of June. But if you go back and look at this historically, and you use an inflation-adjusted index, in other words, take real values, adjust values of dollars so that they're constant dollars over time, the level of margin debt that exists today is about 25% greater than it was even after adjusting for inflation in 2007. And many of you listening to this probably remember the tech stock bubble. Well, there is greater margin debt today than there was at the end of the tech stock run-up. We know what happened in 2000, 2001, and 2002. We know what happened in 2007, 2008, and 2009. And we believe that we're likely in for a significantly greater correction moving ahead. That's our forecast. That's our prediction. There are those out there that will disagree with us. However, we believe our position and our forecast is well-researched and well-founded. If you'd like to learn more, if you'd like to learn about strategies that you might be able to use to protect yourself moving ahead, I would invite you to visit the website newretirementrules.com and get information on our upcoming New Retirement Rules class that will be held at the Western Michigan University campus on the East Beltline in Grand Rapids. The next class will be held on September the 12th. The class begins at 9 a.m. and concludes at 2:30 p.m. The cost for the class is just $49. That includes the book, all the handouts, and lunch for you and a guest. The $49 cost does cover you and a guest. Again, you can get more information or you can register while capacity remains by visiting the website newretirementrules.com. I'd also invite you, if you'd like to listen to our guest expert interviews at any time, you can simply visit the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio. You could also subscribe to our free weekly newsletter titled Portfolio Watch, where I explain our view as to what's going on in the markets. That free subscription to that weekly newsletter is yours by visiting the website YourRetirementOutlook.com. That's YourRetirementOutlook.com. That's our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Bye.